right, welcome back, everybody. Here we are once again talking more Survivor 40 Winners at War. Dom, any updates from you this week? Have you done literally anything this week? Because I sure haven't.
I thought you were getting in there to start judging me, but luckily you're in the same boat that I am. I have done fuck all this week, and it feels great.
No, I actually noticed, I think we may have set an all-time record for us, and this would be like a slow week for RHAP, but we put out 9 podcasts in 14 days, I saw, which is insane. It is good to know that Dom really does love podcasting, just not with me. You've been doing a lot of great work with other people in there. So, actually, we should plug a couple of those things just because some of it's relatively new and people may not have gotten a chance to listen to it yet or seen it yet. I know, weirdly, quarantine, and this is certainly the case for me, quarantine is hurting podcast download numbers. I mean, what I mean is I am myself also getting through far fewer podcasts than normal. But Dom,
I saw some stats on that, and apparently this is true across the board, basically. And it seems counterintuitive at first, but then it makes sense, right? Because you just don't have these like interstitial moments or whatever when you're waiting for something and you can't really do anything properly, so you just put on a podcast for 15 minutes or whatever. Like there's no commute to spend listening to podcasts anymore, so people are at home doing things that are more productive, and shame on them, honestly, for doing that.
It's always interested me when I've heard him bring this up, but I think it is an astute observation on his part. I remember hearing Rob Cesternino say at least once or twice over the years that his biggest concern is self-driving cars, that the people being able to do things while they're commuting is been fair. It is completely fair. He does have obviously such a stranglehold on his market that he has carved out for himself, that self-driving cars becoming a common thing probably is the next thing he has to worry about, other than, you know, this would never happen, Dom, but some crazy virus spreading globally and just shutting the entire world down.
I feel like for 99% of the population, the biggest concerns about self-driving cars are, in order, A, this might kill me, B, this might kill somebody else, or I guess C, someone else's self-driving car could kill me when it's just careening off because some part of its algorithm is faulty or whatever, and then D, some like general intelligent, some super omniscient being is going to rise up and devour us all. I think Rob might be the only person for whom it will affect my audience numbers. He's going to appear on that list.
Yes. All right. Well, Dom, speaking of all of the podcasts you have done without me, you did Tiger King with Kirsten recently. I know a lot of people have been checking that out. So give that a listen if you have not yet. And then I got to say, and actually, let me not just say, let me copyright this idea. This is copyright Colin Stone 2020. There is, I can't believe that no massively popular podcast exists already, at least to my knowledge. Maybe it does, but there is no finer combination in the world than a delightful British accent and a delightful Australian accent going back and forth. And you and Dan Liebke talking about Australian Survivor was truly one of the greatest audio treats I have ever consumed. I was grinning ear to ear the entire time, just those two accents going back and forth. And whenever that becomes a thing, now that we're all locked inside and people have to come up with new ways to entertain each other, confined within their own walls, the eventual immensely popular project where a British person just talks to an Australian person and people get to enjoy their accents and general vibes, that is my idea, and I get half of all money that is earned through those means.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun, not just for that reason, but also just because Dan's always a treat to talk to. But I definitely felt just, I was basking in the warm glow of his soothing voice as I was doing that. You know, it was a treat for me too.
Mm-hmm. All right, excellent. And then I should also say we posted recently the first part of our coverage of The Mole, which is going on over at Patreon. I released the Merge Boot draft I did with Matt Gagan back, I think it was last July. We finally got to see how that played out. So if that would interest you, definitely give that a listen as well. And then the other thing, that released late last week, but hopefully people got a chance to check it out, and I would strongly recommend doing so if you did not, is we got the opportunity to catch up with our old friend Jordan Parhar talking in general about Survivor 40. And I would say the vast majority of that is actually going to be holding up really well this week. For once in our lives, Dom, we actually did a pretty good job predicting this merge situation, so those takes haven't immediately aged horribly.
Yeah, it is very unfortunate that we were mostly right and there isn't much to correct ourselves on or try and figure out where it all went wrong for us. This was actually pretty straightforward.
Yes. So I think with that out of the way, before we get into the merge happenings themselves, Dom, we are down to 11 players in the game, and that doesn't seem like nearly enough for a modern Survivor merge. So we are going to get one of these old schoolers off of Edge of Extinction, almost called it Redemption Island, and we are going to play this re-entry challenge, this much-anticipated re-entry challenge. And before we do that, the people who have fire tokens to spend are going to do so. And I believe it was the case that they had to, like, lock in their decision before they necessarily got to see what was upon them. But they did have a reasonable amount of information about what kind of advantages were up for grabs. I don't have the specifics in front of me, but Dom, can you confirm that we did find out the menu that they had to choose from when they had to make their decision?
Back in the main game? Or
no, in the Edge Extinction.
Because we saw the main game menu, which seemed there was like nothing appealing on that list, really, and the only stuff that you would want costs far more fire tokens that anyone could reasonably amass. So I'm sure we'll come back to that, but that was a little confusing to me. But it seemed like you basically have two options when it comes down to it. You can buy an advantage in this challenge. If you have more tokens, you can buy a second advantage and then a third advantage, or you can buy a fully powered idol in the event that you make it back into the game. But one thing that wasn't clear to me was, so Rob and Natalie both bought one advantage and one idol, and so they go back to the Edge presumably with their idols in tow now, right? But do they... So they're just camping out there for the next however many days. When the second re-entry challenge comes around, if they win that, then I assume their idol is still alive at that point. And I also don't know if... let's say Rob had bought the idol and then Amber goes back into the game. Can Rob sell Amber his idol? Can he give her his idol? Or how exactly does all that work?
I do not believe it would be the case that... if he had been so inclined, Boston Rob could have just tossed his idol to Tyson in this situation, snuck it to him, I would imagine, would be the move, rather than making it clear to everyone in the main game that that's something to be worried about.
Sure.
But no, I would imagine you cannot. I think they almost went out of their way to make it clear that we're basically betting on Rob being the one who has a much better chance here.
Yeah, and Amber basically said, look, I was here for Rob in the first place. I was here just to do what I could to help him along and help him win. And that really is coming to play here on the Edge, where they pool their tokens. But what that means in practice is Amber gives Rob her token, which means Rob gets to like have everything he wants, right? He gets the idol and the advantage. Having seen how the challenge plays out, maybe he wish he could have got two more advantages instead. But when you have to lock this in advance, I kind of understand Rob saying that, like, look, even if I make it back into the game, I have such a high profile and I will be the only old schooler coming back into this this group of young whippersnappers that I'm going to need the idol to make anything happen. So I think I'm probably not the favorite, but one of the favorites in this challenge to begin with. I'm going to take my chances there. And then if I do come back, I'm going to give myself the best chance possible back in the main game. So I think it makes sense for Rob to get the idol, and by the same token, Colin, that Natalie can also buy the idol and then just bank on her athletic prowess coming into play. But this does prove something that we've been speculating for a while, which is these fire tokens and them having really any use at all seems to be firmly gated by Edge of Extinction, where if, let's say, Rob had just bought nothing and come back into the game, his four fire tokens would, there's not really much he can do with them, right? Like, he has to rely on someone on the edge making him an offer through some kind of trial or deal or whatever, but there's not much he can do with his giant stack of fire tokens to really make anything happen. And we're seeing Michelle in the situation in the main game where she has as many fire tokens as anyone else, but what does that count for? What good does that do her right now?
Right. And I do agree that in the case of specifically Boston Rob, I am willing to be a lot more understanding, I think, than most of the discussion I've heard, kind of killing Rob and Natalie for not maxing out on the advantages. When you are Boston Rob, I think it is totally fair to say to yourself, it is exceedingly unlikely that I will be making it through the main game if I re-enter without playing an idol or two at some point. That it just seems almost off the table. However, I do not know if that is necessarily the case for Natalie, and even in both of their cases, I do think an argument can be made for maxing out on the advantages when you know that, and I believe they knew that no one else could afford more than one advantage. I finally have this information. They don't have the knowledge when they're making this decision that this obstacle course will be followed by a high variance snake puzzle or whatever you want to call that, snake hand-eye coordination test, snake maze, I don't know. They don't know that it's going to come down to that afterwards, and there will be a ton of variance involved there, but when they're making the decision, they do know. It's not a situation like we had speculated about a couple weeks ago when just theorizing about, well, should you max out on advantages or not? Because what you don't want to see happen is you are essentially like Malcolm in that Final Four challenge where, yes, you have the advantage, but he could have had 100 retries and he never would have won that challenge where, okay, if you're just bad at it, you're bad at it, and you're just wasting your fire tokens on these additional advantages. I think it is very much worth noting the choices they got to see when making this decision. And the three advantages that they knew were in play were the one that they all chose, which is you don't have to dig up your bag of whatever, and then the other two advantages that they got to see ahead of time were, for one more fire token, you can have your stick pre-made, I assume by like the Dream Team or whatever. You don't have to tie your key removal stick and make sure it's strong enough and long enough, I guess, for Jeff Probst. And then the third one is you can move the key closer to you. So with that in mind, I actually think, and the math here does not work out super well in the case of Boston Rob, but to me, if you get to pick and choose which one of those you want, rather than having to take them in the order in which they come up in the challenge, I would see a ton of value in that pre-made stick. I feel like there is no chance they are going to give you a stick that cannot really easily hold on to that key. And I am, I think, willing to give, at the very least, Natalie a hard time for not going for that instead. I think that is a very worthwhile advantage.
Yeah, assuming you can make that choice, that does seem like the easy one. You have to think they are not going to give you some floppy, fragile stick. You're going to get something that will do the job properly, and that seems like it will save you so much more time, unless the digging part is super hard, like even more so than they made it out to be on TV. I know Parvati actually has said in the past that late in the game, when she just felt exhausted, the digging part of those challenges was always the toughest thing for her, where you just don't have the energy to just heave up the sand and everything. But even with that in mind, if you can buy exactly two advantages, and as you said, the math doesn't really work out here for anybody. But
it
works
for Natalie, in my opinion.
Yeah, it works for Natalie. If you have those tokens to spare, I think you definitely want the stick, and you could definitely get on board with the not skipping the digging too. I don't know how much value the key being closer really has, but if you can afford it, then sure, why not, right?
Well, I would say I actually feel like someone like Tyson could have kind of hacked this a little bit, unless they move the key based on how long your arms are or whatever. But if I was Tyson Apostle, I would be pretty comfortable that even with the target further away, if I have no digging and a pre-made stick, I am very easily going to be able to reach this thing and retrieve it in no time.
Yeah, the thing with this challenge, though, is that the final portion where you have to maneuver the ball through the like the vertical maze is it requires such specific skills that there are people who took part in this challenge where if you just started them at that point, they still would have no shot, basically, of winning their way back.
Right, and that's why I think if the advantage was, like, say you had to land multiple balls and your advantage was you get to land one fewer, for many people that would be a useless advantage.
Yeah, and we actually saw, they only mentioned you have to sink one ball, but we saw the second one off to the side, and we don't know how close this actually was. Like, they presented it as this photo finish down to the wire, you know, Tyson edged him out by just a few seconds, but maybe Tyson just lapped Rob with the second ball, and it was, you know, it was a done deal from the outset. But
I was surprised it was only one ball, but I did not notice that it was that you could see they were running a multi-ball thing. That makes a lot more sense, because I was one of the people who bought that it came that close, but that could easily have just been Rob's first ball, and I would be shocked if it was anything else.
And I believe the last time they did this challenge, they did the exact same thing. So maybe this is their go-to MO with this.
Credit to them. That's a really good idea. I mean,
you
should make it two balls, and you should cut it down for TV and make it suspenseful. This is a win-win-win.
Yes. Please lie to me for the sake of making good TV. That's what I signed up for. I know that. I'm okay with it. But, yeah, this effectively came down to which of Rob and Tyson and maybe a handful of other people were going to get a chance to compete in the challenge. And so these advantages were just buying them some extra time over that subset of competition, and they didn't have to worry about the rest.
Right. Well, I would say this snake puzzle, I feel weird, first of all, calling it a puzzle. It is certain. I don't know what to call it. I'm sorry. But this snake maze thing, contraption, is something with a high learning curve, I would imagine, where it takes a minute to get used to it, but once you get used to it, you can pretty quickly get your bearings. And people who have three or four more attempts with it will have a pretty big advantage. And that is what most of my analysis comes down to, is I feel like saving the digging and getting the pre-made stick are going to buy you at least a couple of minutes over the field. And a couple of minutes is an eternity in that sort of environment, where when you are first starting out on that contraption, you are just hopeless at running it up. It's going to take you a few drops to get there. Being able to buy that time to more than I would imagine make up for that learning curve, I think, is immensely valuable.
Yeah, but in any case, we're discussing the choices that Rob and Tyson and Natalie and these other players had. Not all of them really had any meaningful choice at all, and foremost among those is Yul, who gets sent to the Edge of Extinction and then immediately has to come back around and do this challenge with no opportunity not just to spend fire tokens, but to re-earn any fire tokens, whereas the most recent pre-merge boot, which you would think lasting longer in the game should be an accomplishment that would reward you for surviving longer than just getting voted out on day three or day six. Instead, Yul has zero fire tokens and has to just run this challenge as they drew it up, where I don't know how good a shot he would have had anyway, but this certainly didn't help matters. And this is really driving home the point that I know you have made and Dalton Ross made to a lot of agreement on Twitter this week, that it is such an obvious and blatant disadvantage to be voted out later in that portion of the game. And it feels like that shouldn't be the case. Something has gone wrong if you would much rather be voted out first than voted out seventh.
Right. I totally agree with that. And we saw, like, in previous iterations of this sort of thing, Redemption Island worked because they were happening. Like Redemption Island, I guess, I'm not going to say it worked. It didn't face this particular issue because the battles were happening after every single boot. So the people like Matt Elrod or like Ozzy had to win a ton to get their way back. You know, Ozzy the second time. I had to win a bunch to get their way back in. And it wasn't just like, not only doesn't matter how early you got voted out, everyone has the same chance on day 36. It is tipped massively in favor of the people who got voted out early because of these advantages that are up for grabs that you can only get if you have been there long enough to accumulate some fire tokens. So yeah, definitely some work to be done here in terms of adjusting this mechanism in the future. But I think this also ties into a potentially less successful tweet that I had this week talking about how I am certainly not suggesting, although I do understand that it may have read this way, I am not saying at all that Wendell should have been at the merge saying, hey, please vote me out. I'm going to quit and go to Edge of Extinction because I think that's where I want to be right now. But given that this is how things played out for Wendell, where it seems pretty clear he was not going to be finding footing within the big group, and it seems extraordinarily unlikely that Wendell was going to make his way through and find some path to victory via the main game. In retrospect, like, as Wendell is on his way now to Edge of Extinction, I completely understand not being thrilled in the moment, but there is absolutely no question in my mind that Wendell's win equity went way up this week for being voted out and having the opportunity to, as quickly as possible, get onto this alternate path to victory.
Yeah, you don't want to be voted out when the game is up in the air, but let's say you could go back to day one and tell Parvati that you are going to be swapped onto a tribe where you are dead to rights. There's basically nothing you can do. Would you rather wait it out and get voted out when you're going to be voted out? Or would you rather go home now on day three? Given the structure of this game that they set up, you pick up your bags and you go there right now. Like, you leap at that chance, and that feels wrong. Like, that should not be that should not be what you want to be doing.
So I don't have any real solution to that at this hour. Do you have anything that comes to your mind in terms of how we can balance this better in the, I feel, not entirely unrealistic scenario where both Fire Tokens and Edge of Extinction are both on the same season again?
Nothing immediately comes to mind. Maybe you could have something where they compete for Fire Tokens one last time before going to this challenge, but then you couldn't really air that because that would take up too much time in this episode. So nothing, I don't think there is a good way of doing it. I'm willing to be proven wrong, but that work should be done in advance. Like, if you have to burn a season or sacrifice the integrity of one season to try this out and get a good sense for how Fire Tokens work and how to integrate them into the game, that's an unfortunate price to pay, but maybe you have to pay it. And if so, then you do that with just a random cast. Like, if you've done that on Island of the Idols, I don't think anyone would have been complaining too much. But this is the last season where you should be trying things out before you've had a chance to smooth out those rough edges. And I worry increasingly that we're going to flip from Fire Tokens being basically irrelevant in the main game, which is not what you want if you're going to go to all this work of implementing them in the first place, to they're going to come up in a way which is just overpowered or just suddenly twist the game in a new direction that no one could or should have seen coming.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, the silver lining, I think, about Survivor potentially being delayed is they will have more time than they otherwise would have to figure out what they want to do about the future of Survivor. And while we disagree with a lot of the creative decision making, and they do not historically seem super interested in listening to people like us, they are at least willing to listen, I would say, to other people within the Survivor. Not that they should be necessarily listening to us, but to fans and other people in the Survivor community. Like, if there is a big enough outcry against Edge of Extinction, as we've seen, they will get rid of Edge of Extinction. And over the years, I know Rob and Steven have done Survivor think tanks along the way where they and listeners have submitted ideas that have wound up on the show. It seems clear to me that meaning the producers now, are open to whatever suggestions Tyler Perry or other people may have to submit to them. And I think, what better time is there to try to generate some sort of new ideas, I would say. I think this is potentially going to be a real turning point for Survivor, seeing how things go on the heels of this big blowout all winter season. And I would very much like for that to be as good as possible. So I would really strongly encourage any listeners out there to, if you have good ideas for twists, tweet them at Jeff or at us, or who try to get the ball rolling, I would say. Post them publicly, because this seems like a real opportunity for some big changes to be made. And I'm optimistic, cautiously, that they could be good ones.
I agree with the general thrust of that. However, Fire Tokens as a concept, this is the kind of thing which you might see on like a fan-made or a College Survivor or some like ORG somewhere. And you think, okay, well, that's an interesting idea, but maybe it's going to take a while to actually work out how to do this properly. And that's fine. Maybe you have a few iterations of it before it's in a form where you're happy running it back time and time again. But you will never get a chance to do this season over again. Like, this is the one shot you have at doing the most iconic season of all time that we've been waiting decades for. Why now? Like, why use this as a season to heap all of that risk on in case it does all go pear-shaped?
It is certainly a good question. I believe the common response to that would be that this is the most reliable cast to make this new twist interesting, that they are an advanced group of players that will understand the complexity that this adds and go out of their way to try to play with this in mind.
Oh, okay, but they can make it interesting once the twist has been refined into a form where it's most easily made interesting, right? Like, if it turns out, as it seems to look at the moment, that your fire tokens in the main game are just kind of useless, then it doesn't matter what kind of creative ideas a Denise or a Jeremy or an Adam is going to have, because what are they meant to do with it? Whereas if you had done this before and you know what kind of things to put in the menu to make it more tantalizing, then you might see those big brain ideas come into play more.
Oh, I completely agree that this new merge fire token menu is a nightmare. I couldn't believe how little was going on there when I saw it. When I saw them show up to camp, and a new menu was posted, I was super excited about, okay, here we go, finally. Fire tokens are about to get really exciting in the main game, and all we really hear about is how the prices have gone up, which, by the way, Jeff Pittman noted on Twitter, prices exactly the same on all of the items that were previously offered. We find out that, I don't believe this was offered in the past, the people can steal a reward now for, I think, 3 fire tokens, or send maybe 2 or 3 fire tokens for each of these, or send a letter to someone, or multiple people maybe can probably get their hands on it once it's there, to the edge of extinction. Do you see anyone exercising their option to do either of these?
I really don't, unless that message is so important that you're going to get something really substantial in return. Maybe if there was some connection on the season, like, for example, this would be the perfect thing to have on a menu in a blood versus water season, right? Where you have someone maybe on the edge or on redemption, whatever island is there after the sidelines, where the thing you most want in life at that moment is to just hear from them and to be able to talk to them. At that point, sure, you can go and do that. On a season like this, I struggle to imagine anyone taking them up on that opportunity. So that item is just dead weight on that menu, effectively. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, my one idea on the letter to the edge, admittedly, was sparked by the idea of, I don't want to send a letter to the edge of extinction. I want to receive a letter from someone that I trust on Edge of Extinction, where they get one page to tell me as much pertinent information as they can. And so if I'm the one who has to send the letter, I don't know if the producers would be into this idea or not, but the best I could come up with was, I am going to send you, Dom. Well, not you, Dom. It's going to be someone I trust. I'm going to send my ally.
You are not getting my fire token. Okay.
I'm going to send my ally on Edge of Extinction some sort of code so that come next tribal council, they can signal to me the the way the jury is feeling about the people left in the main game. I feel like that would be a compelling use of the Edge of Extinction correspondence power. I would definitely clear that I would be allowed to do this with the producers before I would spend the money on it.
Right.
But if I was told, hey, if you can come up with a system where someone can non-verbally communicate to you some sort of jury threat tiers at tribal council, then go for it. That would potentially appeal to me, but I four fire tokens feels like $1 million at this point compared to what most people have.
Yeah. So in the past, they have been incredibly draconian about any perceived implication, let alone communication explicitly with the jury from the main game, to the point of like chastising jury members at tribal council for like grinning too obviously about people left in the game. But I don't know if with this being an option on the menu, if they're willing to relax that a little bit and to, you know, this might be one of those things where you ask for forgiveness rather than permission. Like if you buy the advantage and then try to send a code to someone on the edge, they might not have sanctioned that if you'd asked them, but now that it's being done, they might think, okay, I admire the moxie. Let's go with this and see what happens.
I suspect they're going to read the letter before they deliver the letter. I suspect it's not like jail. There's not a lot of private communication going on.
Well, yeah, I'm not saying you can try and sneak it past them, but once you propose this idea, maybe they're on board with it, whereas if someone is just like meekly requesting it, they're just going to shut it down without a thought.
Right. So that was the best I could come up with for the letter to Edge of Extinction. But I certainly would have loved to see, hey, three fire tokens, hidden immunity idol. And that's what we're doing for hidden immunity idols going forward in this post-merge scenario. I thought that was more along the lines of what we would be saying, right? Like two fire tokens, you get an idol nullifier or something like that.
I will say I do like that. The immunity offers fire tokens now as an incentive to actually try to win that. Because in the past, you said it often makes sense for a lot of people to just throw these immunities, try and not draw too much attention to themselves. And I could definitely see this going the other way, where someone who already is likely to win their way to the end via the challenges now has a massive leg up, where, you know, if you're Mike Holloway, who, or maybe a winner who's actually on the season, if you're a Tyson, let's say, and you're winning four challenges in a row, well, now you have four fire tokens, and that could maybe buy you an idol, which then effectively grants you safety even if you don't win the next challenge, and that could all be a mess. So I'm actually withdrawing this already. I actually don't like this idea at all. However, when I did like it, it was for very good reasons, so I think we should all respect that.
when I began this sentence, I was an entirely different person than I am today.
Yes, I've changed, I've learned, and I'm moving forward. I'm being a better me.
All right, so... The one final question I had about this new fire token menu is, it says on the bottom that it ends on day 34, which is, I would imagine, right around final 7, final 6, something like that, which I just found myself wondering, when the things on the menu are steal a reward, send a letter to Edge, and then like rice and beans and blankets and pillows and stuff like that, that I would imagine, who cares if they're buying it on day 37, 38, 39, why day 34? Why? I don't know why this stood out so much to me. It just seemed like a bit early to be calling it there.
I don't ask me. I have nothing to offer on that.
I don't know. I'm guessing this will most of the time lead to absolutely nothing, but I was trying to figure out why they were cutting this off at a time that seemed relatively early compared to what I would have expected. But regardless, Dom, I think let's move it along. Tyson is officially going to be back in the game now. We are making excellent time, as usual. Let's dive into the latest goings-on here out in Fiji, and right away... not a great start for the merge here, as far as I am concerned, as during the merge feast, Denise Stapley is somehow becoming an enormous target within this game. I mean, I guess that is a kind of a byproduct of losing Boston Rob and Parvati and Sandra all in a row is that even the smallest people physically left in the game are going to start standing out. But in this retelling of her story of how she overcame this 4-1 bad swap draw to play two idols and become the Queen Slayer, Sophie, I think, is the one to vocalize Denise suddenly putting a pretty big target on her back. And Dom, this is a concern for me, first of all, as a not just a Denise Stapley fan. I am a legit stan of Denise Stapley, but also as someone who felt like just hitting the merge for Denise was going to be such a big checkpoint. And finally now she can float back, or I guess fade back under the... What does one do to get under the radar? Probably not float, but... you know what I'm saying, where it shocked me to see Denise coming out as such an early target here. And maybe that's just a byproduct of, hey, Denise is going to win immunity and we want people to be happy about that and feel like that potentially saved her. And that's a big suspenseful moment. But either way, don't love to see this for Denise right away.
Yeah, and maybe this is just a product of Denise's blindside, which admittedly, for me at least, ranks up there with one of the at least best TV moves of all time. It is really the only move of any kind, let alone big move, that's taken place on this season so far, right? Because you might expect coming in with all of these winners who maybe some of them do have something to prove, and as Michelle likes to remind us, she's proving that she deserves to be there. But all of them want to show that they are the best of the best, right? And the way to do that is to just knock off your biggest competition and to really make a big profile for yourself. And no one is really doing that so far. We're not getting the fireworks that maybe you would have expected coming into the season. So if anyone at all is making a move like this, and it's going to stand out, and especially with it coming so close, relatively speaking, to that merge, there's not really anything else to talk about in terms of what's been going on in the game.
It is potentially getting to the point now, Dom, where I will always credit Sierra Easton as being the poster child of like the big moves era and big moves becoming like the sexy new thing that everyone needed to make it deep in a game of Survivor. We may now be at the point where the discussion about what big moves everyone has on their resume every single final tribal council has swung us back to like the opposite end of the horseshoe, where now the smartest way to play is small moves because everyone's going after the people making big moves right away.
Right. And this was an argument that we saw come up on Australian Survivor this season, where it's like, okay, you're criticizing me for not making big moves, but look at what happens with people who made the big moves, and the self-appointed mastermind strategist, they all just got lopped off as soon as the opportunity presented itself. So what are you expecting me to do?
Well, the mere mortals did.
Well, yes, of course.
Right. So it's going to be interesting for sure to see how this all plays out in terms of who emerges as big threats right away, because I feel like you are dead right. We're right around the halfway point, to kind of like back of the napkin Survivor math there through this game. And Denise really is the one standing out in terms of a resume from this time around. And after this merge situation, which we will certainly talk about further, I'm not sure I have much more clarity on who has the upper hand in making the next big move, or who's even looking to make the next big move here. So going to be very curious to see just kind of the power rankings along the way here, because certainly things are going to have to happen. We're going to be going to tribal councils every 2 or 3 days, and people are running out of meat shields very quickly here. But it does seem like a situation that I never would have anticipated, frankly, where no one other than Denise from that one tribal council, who is left still in the main game, has anything too noteworthy, I would say, on their Survivor resume from this time around.
So how much do you think it's going to be based on events of this season versus some like lingering legacy from previous seasons, where for Denise, who played a quiet but thoughtful game the previous time and was intentionally trying to hide behind Malcolm for most of that and not draw attention to herself in that incredibly chaotic merge, like much more chaotic than this seems to be at the moment. A move like this maybe stands out more as a contrast, as opposed to someone who made a name for themselves on their season by making moves like this, and now that they're here, it's just more of the same.
I would imagine on day 39, most people are going to be thinking about what they have seen from that person over the last couple of weeks in real time, as like the end game is all playing out. But at this point in the game, and certainly during the beginning of the game, what people did on their previous seasons, I would say, played the lion's share of the role in how things ended up playing out, just by sheer virtue of the Boston Rob and anyone who was ever once familiar with him alliance becoming immediate targets from every single tribe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I also did enjoy Sophie in her classic fashion of very eloquently, but just very like subtly, snarkily, chiding Denise through the medium of analogy, just like calling her out, but without really calling her out.
Yeah, very a strong suit of Sophie's Clark, the plural, all the Sophie's Clarks out there, very good at that sort of thing. So beyond Denise potentially overhyping, not even overhyping, by the way, I would say she undersold the epicness of that tribal council. Like, to me, you know, Parvati playing two idols during the Heroes versus Villains merge is widely regarded as one of the greatest tribal council moments, or like Kelly Wentworth getting to blindside Andrew Savage and having 10 votes canceled out. Those were both situations where the person was pretty aware of the political dynamic and knew what they were up against. And you know, found the idols themselves and just been waiting for the right time. Denise, I believe, had gotten that idol, like, I don't know, a couple hours prior, somewhere in that neighborhood. And I can't imagine even she herself thought anything like that was conceivable the morning they woke up for that tribal council. And just the rapidness with which that came together, I think, adds and also the 4-1 nature of it, where it's literally every single vote except for Denise's is canceled out, I think really puts it over the top into like the all-time elite tier. And if anything, Denise may have been underselling the legend status of that tribal the all-time reputation of that tribal council. But at this point in the main game, that's like a 15 out of 10 when no one else has hit a 4 yet.
Right. It's all a matter of relativity, I suppose.
Right. So after all of that goes down, we hear a little bit from Tyson, who has just re-entered, and he's talking about how if he is given the opportunity to find some cracks within the game, he hopes to be really calculated and good, I guess, at planting some kind of roots and letting letting everything grow. I'm very quickly losing track of this metaphor here, Dom, or whatever it is, analogy here, Dom. But Tyson, I wanted to get into a little bit because it seems like he kind of established that mission statement of hang in the background, build some good bonds with people, hope not to get cut down right away, and reap some longer-term rewards from that later on. I know we didn't get to see nearly everything that got talked about, and I'm sure Tyson's name got thrown out there at some point by someone during all of the merge vote scrambling, but your take so far on Tyson, as far as I can tell, pretty effortlessly finding a place back in the main game, despite all of the stigma, I would imagine, that comes with being the Edge of Extinction re-enterer in a post-Chris Underwood world.
It was very impressive, yeah. And we saw some discussion among the other contestants of exactly why that was. And I think it was Tony and a few others made some good points that the reasons that Tyson was gone the first time, it wasn't because he was Tyson and we have to take out Tyson. It's he's a part of this larger core that includes, Rob and Amber and, even Kim. Like, Kim wasn't on the outs at the start because, well, Kim's social game has really been slacking lately and she just doesn't have it anymore. It's because she was seen as part of that alliance and they had to trim down that alliance. And it was also because, Yul was trying to harness Sandra's spite towards Robin Amber and her fear of Tyson, and then using the idea of Tyson coming after her to like drive some wedge between the two of them. And every name that I've mentioned there, with the exception of Tyson, is no longer in the game.
Yeah.
Those reasons that Tyson was a big threat early on, not to say there wouldn't have been other good, perfectly valid reasons, like Tyson just being one of the all-time best players. You could definitely vote him out on that basis, but the reasons he went when he did no longer apply. So, you know, he's not immediately going to be Matt Elrod. He's not going to be kicked back through the revolving door.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, now that Sandra has come up, I did want to say... I liked it that they included the shot when everyone showed up to watch the re-entry challenge. The people in the main game got to sit on the bleachers and sweat the whole thing. I did think it was nice of them to include, I think it was Tony who said, oh yeah, of course Sandra would leave. There's no way she was doing this. And it sounds dismissive or demeaning, but I think he did intend it, and I think it came across this way as like, oh, it's completely understandable that Sandra would not want to stick around for this.
Yeah, and the people who would give Sandra the most grief for that, I think probably, you know, Tony is immune from their usual criticism, so it's good to hear that coming from him, too.
Mm-hmm. All right, so yeah, overall, though, really impressive stuff from Tyson, as far as I am concerned, just given the seemingly unanimous... distrust or mistrust, I'm never sure about, or at least uneasiness towards the old schoolers to this point, and just as you mentioned, the reputation that comes with Tyson Apostle anytime he's playing Survivor, at least post Heroes versus Villains, I would say, is certainly something that people are going to be aware of. So off to a good start, it seems, on that front. I guess let's get into the immunity challenge, which is actually one that has been won by Tyson Apostle many, many years ago in Token Sheens. This time not going to go his way. It is the hang on to a totem pole, 10, 15, I don't know, however many feet in the air. And Dom, maybe not the challenge to run during a rainstorm that is destroying everyone's ability to grip the totem pole.
And also when the rain is turning the sand into a much harder surface than it would be normally. But yeah, as much as I like watching this challenge and it's a good, reliable standby, I don't know if this is a safe challenge, honestly, because we've seen a bunch of people take some really hard falls in the past. Like we saw Michelle here kind of on the ground and Adam having to go and help her up and make sure she was okay.
Hey,
and
hey, then... she does not need to be carried, bro.
yes, thank you. But then also back in Game Changers, we saw Andrea like fall from the top of the pole, and I was worried for a second that she had broken something. But maybe the fact that none of them have been seriously injured suggests it's okay. I don't know where I meant to land on that.
You do not know how mad I was when I was rewatching the episode and realized I missed the "I don't need to be carried, bro" live tweet. That would have killed.
It really would.
Yes. So this is actually going to be a double immunity, by the way. The final woman and final man left up on the perch are going to win. And this time around, Queen of Gendered Immunity Necklaces, Denise Stapley, going to repeat what she did in Philippines at that Merge Immunity Challenge and win the women's necklace. And then... which, by the way, I would say checks out. This is certainly a challenge where being small is a pretty big benefit, at least historically, other than the Tysons and Aussies and just total freaks of the world who can win whatever challenge you put in front of them. And then Jeremy ends up coming down with the men's necklace here, and a bit of a trend breaker in that respect. Jeremy, certainly not the smallest guy on this season, although I did hear on Know It All, Steven was talking about Jeremy apparently has like freakish big toes where he could just lock in there. There was nothing that could take Jeremy off of that.
I didn't realize the importance of gigantic toes to winning the challenge, but for all future Survivor players out there, if you think this challenge is coming up in your season, grow bigger toes, I guess. I don't know what you're meant to do with that information.
Yeah, job well done for sure by Denise and Jeremy. If Denise was indeed someone that people were viewing as a big target there. Certainly happy to see her not have to sweat this vote. So we are going to be headed to this merge vote with 12 people that I would have thought would be swinging all over the place. There would be plans A through Q within the first 20 minutes of hitting the merge beach, and we would be on plan ZZZZX by the time this vote rolled around. But at least as far as the TV episode was concerned, it seemed to me like the particularly Wendell and Nick were pretty early in being established as targets, and then Adam's name potentially came up along the way when Jeremy was not thrilled about the prospect of losing Wendell. But at least at this point, it seems like we have the two of the three tribes from the post-swap situation kind of coming together, and the Wendell, Nick, Michelle tribe on the outs. And Dom, this is something I wanted to talk about just in kind of bigger picture terms, because I don't really have many major takeaways, frankly, from the specifics of what we saw play out. I don't expect that it's just going to be a pagonging and Nick and Michelle are just the next to go. And I don't have a real reason to believe in one big alliance coming together that I feel even slightly decent about being able to call ahead of time. But this bigger concept of all-star seasons and just merges with a lot of people, the ones you would expect, I would imagine, to have the most conversations taking place and the most separate agendas being pursued, have at least recently often resulted in some of the most straightforward boots. We certainly saw this in Game Changers and Cambodia. So what is your thought about that, Dom? These kind of all-star season merge votes almost being some of the most anticlimactic points of the game.
I wonder if it's just that you have a decent level of respect for everybody there. You know that if you throw the wrong name out there, then it's probably going to get back to that person, and that person has the talent and the connections to turn it back against you. And you know, maybe you end up as the plan D or E that turns into the plan A when all is said and done. So if there are names who stand out from the group because they aren't that well connected, or no one's going to care too much if they go home, or you start to sense some momentum building around the idea of taking them out, then I think it's even easier than it is normally to jump on that bandwagon instead of trying to drive the vote yourself. Like I think Jeremy was speaking for quite a lot of people when he said that he wants to be driving the vote, but he doesn't want to be driving it from the front. He doesn't want to be the actual driver, right? He wants to be the backseat driver, if anything. Mm-hmm.
And by the way, new nickname for Dom, Plan D. Very much like that. Yeah, I thought it was interesting that Jeremy got a couple of scenes, I think, or at least a couple of confessionals within the same larger scene, talking about how his big goal was to take out Nick, because he thought with Nick gone, Wendell would be most reliant upon him going forward. And both Sophie and Tony seem to be the ones really more interested in taking Wendell out. Sophie in particular gets a confessional talking about how, so pretty clearly Jeremy wants to take Nick out so Wendell can be most reliant upon him, just like completely reading Jeremy to filth, Dom, as the kids say. Sorry, in terms of how this boot ultimately went down, I thought it was interesting that Jeremy got so much screen time for someone who ultimately did not have this go his way.
Yeah, Jeremy really has been popping up a lot more recently, and I love to see it, and everything we're seeing from Jeremy has been great. But it's an excellent example of what you're saying, where it seems so weird for the big move at this pivotal moment in the game to be taking out Nick, right? Like, who would even suggest that except for Jeremy? And maybe that's why he suggests it, right? Where no one thinks about taking out Nick, but the moment the idea comes up, no one cares enough about Nick being there to, you know, put their foot down and say, we have to do something else. Especially now that Yul is gone, like maybe Michelle wouldn't be on board with it. And obviously Wendell wouldn't like it either, but that's the whole point. He's taking away Wendell's other closest option. So those are the only two people who would care. And with Nick gone, now Wendell becomes that person who like is this big controversial figure who Jeremy can hug tight. But then if there's a movement to get rid of Rendell. He can just ditch him and move on with his life. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I don't know what to make. I don't know how to make sense of that. Do you have any thoughts yourself?
On what specifically? Sorry, on what aspect of Jeremy or this situation?
Just that trend that you highlighted of these.
Oh, okay.
It's almost like the better the cast as a whole, or the more agency the cast has, the less exciting the eventual vote is.
So I believe we talked about this right around the premiere time, because to me, I feel like the merge coming together in a modern season where, you know, there you certainly have your Ghost Islands, for instance, where it's a modern season, but we get to the merge, we all regroup with our day one alliance, and we pick them off one by one. That can happen. But in a season with this caliber of players, it almost, I would say, becomes, like I was saying, like a day one situation where so many of them are, I would say, smartly going to take the approach of, I will let someone else emerge as the target here. And my main priority is staying off the radar, because there are enough of us on this beach, someone's going to do something. So as long as I'm not the one initiating some big move here, I feel at least decent enough about my odds of making it through and figuring out what's going on with these other players and crafting a game plan from there and letting other people make mistakes that will guide me toward an easier path to victory here. And I know in an all-winner cast, so, you know, relying on other people to mess up is not necessarily going to be the way you print money, but there are just invariably going to be so many conversations that if you do an effective job of staying under the radar, I think that is a pretty reliable way of making it through this merge and making it to the next round, where pretty much anything can happen. Like, I think so much of the modern season's strategy, not just at the merge, but I think it is pretty exaggerated at the merge now that we're at this individual phase, and people are finally letting themselves start thinking more about like a long-term game plan. The mere knowledge that like idols and advantages are going to constantly fall out of the sky is a pretty big incentivizer. It provides a lot of incentive. I don't know. For people to err on the side of caution. And I think we are just seeing, frankly, the smarter people take an even harder turn in that direction.
I do wonder if Jeremy's plan had worked and Nick had gone, would news of that had got back to Wendell that Jeremy was the one really pushing this? And, you know, it doesn't take a genius to figure out why he would be pushing that. So it feels like this could quite easily have backfired on Jeremy if it worked. And so the fact that it didn't work, but Wendell, or rather Wendell and Nick both know that Jeremy was kind of reluctant to go through with it, maybe that helps him more than anything else.
Yeah, not only did it not work, but now I also...
Oh, sorry, Michelle knows that. Sorry, not Nick, who I understandably would be a little peeved that Jeremy is...
That's what I was going to say, is it could still easily get back to Nick, but I also thought that this is not an effect necessarily for the players out there, but to me, they gave Jeremy the confessional saying, I want to be the driver, but I don't want to look like I'm driving, and then strung together several scenes of, at least for my money, Jeremy pretty blatantly trying to drive the bus towards Nick. And then on top of not only failing at not looking like a driver, he then misses with the drive.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So I little nervous, I guess, would be my conclusion about Jeremy going forward here. It seems like potentially some loose ends still out there in the mix for him. I guess let's get into whatever you have, if anything, from Tribal Council. All I really have here is I was certainly open to the possibility of it being Adam after he had come up as what would ultimately prove to be the decoy boot here. We had talked in past weeks about potentially Merge Boot being one conceivable timeline for why he's getting this kind of weird treatment with the storytelling. But Dom, those fears were subsided as soon as Adams was the first name out of the urn. I know I'm being annoying bringing this up week after week, but I, like, when I was nervous that Adam would leave, I fist pumped immediately after his name was the first one out, because again, the first name out of the urn, like, never is the person who goes home. And I would never, if we were not in a time of quarantine, even suggest that anyone should do this, but someone hearing me right now has next to nothing to do for the foreseeable future and could, if they were so inclined, go back and research how often the first name out of the urn is the person who ends up leaving tribal council. It won't be me who does it, but it could be you, listener out there. I really want to know this information, and you will be credited from now until the end of time with providing this research. And by the way, shouldn't even put this out there. Someone could very easily just make up a number and pretend they did all the research, and yes, I would probably believe you. So don't do that, please.
You will not be the change that you want to see in the world, but someone out there could be that instead.
Yeah, I would be so, now that it has crossed my mind, and rarely did I even notice anything close to that for the first 20 years of being a Survivor fan, but now I am dying to know the percentage of the time that the first name out of the urn does not leave, because it is overwhelming. Either way, Dom, Adam is going to make it through here. We have a 9-3 vote against Wendell, with Wendell, Nick, and Michelle on the outs here voting for Adam. So, as I said, a fairly anticlimactic kind of merge episode overall, and it leaves me really uncertain about making any kind of like big picture calls in terms of who's now looking better now that Wendell is gone. It seems like pretty much everyone other than Nick and Michelle came out of this vote more or less even, other than potentially Jeremy looking like someone to feel a little worse about this week. Any other takeaways from you in terms of how this affects your expectations going forward compared to last week?
Would you say this is a good week for Denise? Because she is a target now, which is, I guess, kind of what she wanted. And if she makes it to the end, she certainly has a lot to hang her hat on now. But is it going to be the first time where she doesn't have immunity, she's going to be looked at seriously as a target again? Or now that initial hype has subsided, is she going to be able to skate by for a little bit longer?
If she can fade into the background, I will, a couple of weeks from now, say, hey, remember that time they flagged Denise up as a big threat at the merge, but then she bailed herself out and everyone was happy about it? I could see that being a very compelling argument down the line if she is able to find her way back in. Not that she's necessarily even on the outs, but if she's able to no longer be someone standing out above the rest of the pack resume-wise, and that becomes a big issue for the Sophies Clarks of the world. At this moment, though, I would probably say, other than Jeremy, Denise would be the person who I have come down the most on in terms of their position in the game this week.
Okay, well, where do you stand on Michelle, who was left out of the vote, who didn't really get a chance to explain her thought process leading into the vote, and the historical precedent in being left out of that merge vote and then going on to recover and win the game is really not encouraging at all.
Right. I remember it was right around the time of Millennials versus Gen X Game Changer, somewhere in there. I did a podcast, a one-off, like, off-season podcast, either just before or just after Game Changers, talking through just merge votes in general with Rob Sesternino. And in researching that podcast, I actually came across a startling statistic that at the time, it was something like only 3 out of 30-plus eventual winners had ever been on the wrong side of the merge vote, and the 3 who made the comeback were Chris in Vanuatu, Danny Boatwright, season 40's own Danny Boatwright in Guatemala, and then Bob Crowley, Maine's own Bob Crowley in Gabon. And all of those were political situations that were super desperate, bailed out by a couple at least one very crucial challenge win. So yes, the path to victory in terms of being on the outs for the merge vote is not a promising one. However, Dom, and I'm sure this conversation is going to continue once we hit the edit zone, I am still holding out hope that someone could add their name to that list.
Yeah, and if there ever is a season to overturn precedents that don't really have a good reason to exist to begin with, this is that season.
Oh, I think it has a very good reason to exist. I think finding yourself in the wrong side of the numbers when everyone's coming together as a big group for the first time, it surprises me that the number is single digit percentage.
Right.
It doesn't surprise me that it is a drastic minority.
I'll clarify. Yeah, it clearly has reason to exist. I don't know if it has a, like, 1 in 13 winners qualify reason to exist. That does seem excessive.
Exactly, yeah. I guess, actually, Dom, it's probably prudent is the word that I was going for and just came up with the closest thing I could think of. So prudent, I would say, to save the Michelle conversation for the edit zone, just to be on the safe side. But before we do that, do you have parting thoughts on Wendell in particular or any other takeaways from Tribal Council?
So here's a thought for you. Maybe these aren't parting thoughts on Wendell. Maybe Wendell is going to make his way back into the game. And I've seen people reach for this theory as a way to explain the rather baffling, in retrospect, amount of attention that was heaped on this whole former relationship drama with Michelle storyline when it really amounted to nothing. And in this episode, like, we heard Wendell say, "I feel great about Nick and great about Michelle." And if you were one of those people who was just, like, tuning in, you've maybe skipped a few episodes, and there's no previously on Survivor to catch you up anymore, you see that, and you think, okay, well, I guess he's cool with Nick, he's cool with Michelle, all right. And you wouldn't
Michelle.
Know that... sure. And you wouldn't know that Nick has been, like, his closest ally out there since day one, and Michelle, he has this, like, weird, just kind of unhealthy drama with. You think, well, they're just clearly both on the same footing, all on the same page. So that was kind of weird. And then for Wendell to get voted out with Michelle getting nothing to say about it feels like a complete lack of closure to that storyline. So maybe the way we get closure is, I guess they could find it on the edge together, but one scenario is that Wendell makes his way back in, and then maybe he has to rely on Michelle to make it further or whatever. But that reunion is how we get that.
I definitely could see that being a scenario that comes in. It was certainly weird to have Wendell's boot episode feature absolutely nothing from Michelle. I've spent the last couple of weeks talking about how it seemed to me like Wendell's entire role within this story seemed to be mostly just figuring into how he played into Michelle's story. But Dom, I would say this is a very worthwhile conversation to have from a ton of different perspectives. I do not feel it would be prudent. Not going to do it, wouldn't be prudent having this conversation outside of the edit zone. So I think he is on Twitter at DomHRV. I am on Twitter at Colin Stone. Email us domandcolin@gmail.com and find our bonus episodes currently diving into The Mole over at patreon.com/domandcolin. But I very much want to continue this conversation.
Okay.
We should do it in fully honest terms, I think.
I will say quickly, and I'll ask you this before we leap over that bumper. What did you feel about this merge episode just as a viewer? Because to me, this is, I said last time, that was the one episode where I was starting to have some doubts about the season. And this episode, you would think, if you'd said to me, you know, a year ago, 18 months ago, we're going to have an all-winner season, and the merge episode is going to be just, like, pretty boring, I would have thought, well, that's, firstly, very surprising, and secondly, a real disappointment. And I would have hoped that, you know, basically anything else could have happened here to spice it up a little bit, but instead it just felt very oddly paced, and then the outcome itself, even though I wasn't the biggest Wendell fan and was keen to see him go, I don't know what I meant to make of that outcome. I'm not sure how I meant to take any real pleasure in it. So I don't know. I heard a good description of the episode as it felt like they were giving you just a summary of the events, like this is what the previously on could have been, instead of the actual events themselves. And I guess that by definition, is what they do every episode of every season. They're trying to distill down the reality into whatever narrow amount of screen time they have. But this felt like they were taking it to a new extreme.
So I would guess that Wendell specifically being eliminated was a bigger sigh of relief for the casuals than it was for the people who have seen and heard from Wendell in every context other than his edit on season 40 and very much like Wendell, where I would guess that most people who don't have that firm of a memory of Ghost Island were pretty satisfied with seeing Wendell get his comeuppance after treating Michelle so badly in this merge boot, in this merge episode, I guess, as the merge boot. But no, I am with you in terms of feeling pretty underwhelmed overall about this episode. I would potentially even go so far as to say that I found the re-entry challenge more exciting than the vote.
Yeah, and we were unhappy to some extent that the re-entry challenge was even a thing that was going to be in this episode because it was going to distract focus from everything else. And maybe it did. Maybe it is actually partially to blame for some of this. But it did feel like that was the climax of the episode, and then everything afterwards was just this afterthought, really.
Yeah. But I am optimistic, by the way, about the state of the season going forward. It just feels like I'm struggling to come up with a good parallel here, but it feels like kind of a Cold War, I guess, where the actual eventual divide is just waiting to be really defined because people don't want to be the first one to make some sort of mistake.
So what shape do you think that divide is taking then? Because it seems like we know that Wendell, Michelle, and Nick were on the outs and maybe will not be going forward. We don't know how clear this divide really is, but for now they were on the outs, but saying who was together seems to be a lot harder. So we have, I guess, Sarah and Sophie are still a thing, and then Sophie was reaching out to Adam and reassuring him, so maybe he's with her and maybe with Sarah too. And then Denise and Adam don't really seem to be a thing anymore, and then Adam and Ben have this weird love-hate relationship where they're always bickering like an actual former couple and yet still voting together all the time. So maybe that parallel
they're basically
there
us
too.
I mean they're, yes. They're pretty much us.
are you the Adam or the Ben, Colin?
I don't know. I don't even want to think about that question.
This is now a Ben Dreeberg and fan podcast, so you know, it's not the slur it might once have been. So we don't quite know what's going on there, and we don't know how Ben feels about Sarah and Sophie either, so unclear what's going on with the four of them. And then it seems like we have this bro down with Tony and Tyson and Jeremy, and then Ben has like worked himself in there too, and people were criticizing him for calling himself a big threat, but I think to some degree you have to believe that to play the game here with any confidence at all. And you saw him getting like starstruck by Boston Rob on the other extreme, so I think it's good to have a healthy self-confidence, you know. But also, like, if Ben is not a big threat, then being able to sell himself as one and get himself into the Big Threat Alliance is more of an achievement, I would say. Like, that is a good play to be making.
Yeah, I mean, when you're talking... Right, sorry. When you're talking to the group of people that are all nervous about the lack of big threats, the thing to say to them is not, well, I'm not a big threat.
Yeah, and I think you saw Tyson make a very heads-up move in reaching out to Ben, who I think he could tell Ben feels a little out of place and he doesn't have close connections, and he also wants to play the game harder and get a chance to prove himself. And so they, you know, they satisfy the need that the other one has in that moment. But it seems like those guys are together. And then maybe as a reaction to that, we have like the Denise and Kim alliance. And then Kim has a tie with Sophie, and I could see Sophie and Denise getting along well. So maybe they link up. But then Denise and Kim also had a thing going with Jeremy. So maybe actually Jeremy once again is just the spoke through which all of this revolves. But I don't know.
Yeah, sorry. It is entirely possible. Last week it seemed to me like Jeremy, both Jeremy and Sarah, I thought were in very similar positions to the situations that went very well for them on Cambodia and Game Changers. Actually, the two most recent all returnee seasons. So was feeling good about that and continue to do so despite potentially coming across as a bit too much of a driver and then potentially not getting his way this time around. But is certainly not ruling Jeremy out by any stretch. But yeah, I would say in terms of the political situation going forward, I don't know what particular group is going to form around them, but I feel very good about Sophie and Sarah being in on whatever majority emerges.
And it was great seeing Sophie immediately clock what was going on with the guys getting together, which is, it's not like it's a new concept by any means, but to see it kind of forming around you and know what to do and know what the good immediate counterstrike to that was really heads up. Because I think if you try and turn it around on one of those people like Tyson or Tony or Jeremy, then maybe that seems like too big of a move and that put Sophie on the radar for the first time. But taking out Wendell, which is something everyone seemed on board with anyway, but also harms that alliance and specifically Jeremy, I think that's a good way to prepare yourself for that eventual war without just like declaring battle immediately.
Right. Okay, so we are, I think, at the point now where we can wrap up the world's longest segue into the edit zone.
Yes, let's do it.
You are listening to the Tom and Colin Edit Zone.
Mike Holloway.
Michelle Ken.
Brad Culpepper.
Rob and Sandra.
You are listening to the Tom and Colin
Edit Zone.
What are you doing?
Tune out now.
Okay, so here we are now finally, Dom, in the Edit Zone. And let's return to that conversation about the way that this story was told in terms of Wendell leaving and Michelle having, I think, literally nothing to say about it. Over the course of this whole episode, I don't think she got a single confessional or a scene talking through how she was hoping for things to go tonight. But it is worth noting, Dom, Michelle was on the outs here, and I certainly came away from this merge feeling, at least relative to how I had felt the weeks prior, much worse about Michelle's winning chances than I would have expected to the hour before I watched the episode. But if there is a situation where it's good to be invisible at the merge, this seems like that situation, even though it leaves a lot unresolved with Wendell.
Yes, but then it feels like we're kind of trying to have it both ways, where if Michelle gets a lot of content and screen time in the episode, then it's a great episode for Michelle. And if Michelle gets nothing, then, oh, well, this is the perfect time for Michelle to be hidden. And like I don't know at that point what a bad episode for Michelle would need to look like.
Where she gets nothing but is in on the vote. That would be what a bad episode for Michelle would look like. What I think is much better than getting nothing while being in on the vote is getting nothing while being out of the vote, because they are not airing you talking about being sold on the incorrect game plan.
It feels like, and we've seen them do this with Michelle in the past, they could easily find enough content from her to, even if she doesn't quite know what's going on and is not going to be in on the eventual vote, at least explain her mindset and with her and what her side of things is and what she hopes to happen, even if it doesn't happen, to give us a window into her mindset. And instead, we just got none of that. And after the vote, we see Nick confirm with Michelle that she was left out of it. She didn't know, which is not a great look for her either. So maybe we'll get in here next week and Michelle will have a really insightful confessional on her take on the whole situation and how she plans to like readjust and pivot in the game now that Wendell's gone. But until I see that, I would be concerned. It's not a great look. And I know last week I was ready to lock it in the moment that rock-ish music was being played over her walk to tribal council and that confessional. But it turns out that we're using that music and just banging the soundboard several times an episode these days. So maybe it doesn't count for anything anymore.
Yeah. Well, I, as I said, am lower on Michelle relative to the rest of the field than I was last week after this merge episode, but I am not nearly as inclined to really drastically reduce her chances as it seems like some people are after a completely invisible merge episode. And I do totally get it. Like, it is very, very rare that the eventual winner is just nowhere to be found on the merge episode. But if there were a situation that would warrant that sort of treatment, I feel like this would be the one where we big up Michelle week after week after week when she's in on what's going on. We don't mention it at all when she's on the outs. And then I suspect, Dom, going forward, it will be a lot more positive focus on Michelle when things are going her way. While I have come down on her winner chances this week, I remain at approximately 99% that Michelle Fitzgerald will not just be in the finale. I believe Michelle is either squarely the winner or a losing finalist. And I frankly believe the only person she can lose to at this point is Tyson.
Wow, that's a bold claim.
Actually, I don't know if I necessarily believe that.
Okay, good.
maybe she's being set up as the robbed goddess at like final four or five or whatever in there. 100% to be in the finale. I would say 90% at this hour to be a finalist in the final three with probably after this kind of merge, I would probably split that about 50-50 between winner or losing finalist. But at this point, I am right around still 40-ish percent feeling about Michelle winning.
I was going to say, based on the notes, you had people other than Tyson and Michelle being in the mix.
Right, right. That's
mathematically cannot be the case if Michelle is in the finals and beats everyone else. Yeah,
yeah, that's how I realized I was wrong.
When we spoke about only a handful of winners across the entire history of Survivor ever being left out of a merge vote and going on to win, there is an analogous statistic for confessionals in the merge episode too, which is the last person to win a season without having a confessional in the merge episode was Natalie Anderson 11 seasons ago. And even in that case, you have firstly the fact that she also apparently would have been left out on the wrong side of the vote had it occurred then and there, according to the post-game press, but then also the fact that that episode was effectively suspended because of Julie quitting, and you have this like two-part merge episode instead, kind of, if you want to classify it that way. And I remember a few things about our previous coverage, but I remember coming in that week and saying, okay, I've been picking up Natalie the whole time, and then she doesn't get a merge episode confessional. What the fuck is going on? And it turns out that actually it was kind of as I thought, but they wanted to just throw me a little curveball along the way. And I don't even know, once you remove Natalie from the mix, how far back you would have to go to find another example. So again, this would be fairly unprecedented, but again, this is a good season to break those precedents.
Yeah. Well, I said that I feel like the only person who could beat her in the finals is Tyson, and I may stand by that part. It is just the part that I think is obviously logically inconsistent is if she's either a winning or the winner or a losing finalist, and the only person who can beat her is Tyson, there should be the only two candidates, which they are not for me. So I am open to the possibility that she makes a deep run and comes up just short, but I feel it is overwhelming that she is going to be in there in the finals, and if she is the compelling losing finalist, I also think it is overwhelming that Tyson is the person who beats her.
You really think there's no way she could lose to Tony or Sophie or Jeremy or any of these other people who just on the face of it seem like they would be very hard for anyone to beat in a final jury vote?
I think she could lose to Tony. I would be certainly open to the prospect that things could, you know, there's a lot of episode time left. By finale night, I could easily see Sophie being the number one contender. I could easily see Tony being the number one contender or Tyson being the number one contender. But prior to Tyson this episode getting to talk about his family a few times, I think it may literally be true that Michelle had spent more time talking about how she's out to prove to the world that she deserved to win the first time and she's going to deserve to win this time than every single member of the cast had gotten to talk about their families combined. And that is not worth overlooking.
Let's get into that point then, because there is an explanation for that. And that's that the first time when you play, you maybe do not have $1 million just yet, and winning that first $1 million does wonders to secure the future of you and your family. Now, you know, you have that nest egg ready to go. You've proven to, you know, you've sent a message to your kids in the world or whatever, for whatever that's worth, and you've got the money in your bank account. You don't need to do it for your family anymore. So like, Jeremy's not going to come in here and say, okay, well, I really want another $2 million so I can get like a holiday home, and, you know, I can get a nice new Ferrari. Like, he's got the basic hierarchy of needs accounted for at this point. So he's out there just to play Survivor again and to do his best to win. But I don't know if that needs to translate into, I have to talk about my family at every moment, or I'm just going to drop off the list.
Dominic, plan D. It certainly does not translate to Jeremy's financial priorities as prior to winning $1 million in Cambodia. But from the perspective of the people editing this show for a casual audience, if the winner has a spouse and kids, we are going to hear about it. And that is why I feel like Tyson is so heavily in the mix, because he gets to talk about his kids nonstop.
He does. And let's move on to Tyson then, because our listener and frequent contributor, Tom Palmer, says something which it sounds weird at first, but I think it might actually be true, which is Tyson coming back in this week worsened his chances of being the winner from an edit perspective.
Yes, I liked that point a lot.
Yes, because if Tyson had remained on the edge and was scheduled to come back in the second time, then you might wonder why they were giving us all of this Tyson content up front. And the best explanation would be, because you think they would have so much more time to do it later on post-merge, if and when we check back on the edge, you know, you can find some great Tyson confessionals to put in there now and again. But instead, we had, you know, this drip feed through the first few episodes of every single time we'd check in with Tyson, and Tyson would be up to some zany antics or giving some really deep personal content. And then even this episode, when he won that re-entry challenge, he spoke about how, you know, he often uses humor as a mask, which is, you know, more self-insight than we have from most people on most seasons ever, honestly, in that 1 second. So lots of great stuff from Tyson, but maybe that's just because he comes back in and you want that moment to mean something. Whereas if he didn't come back in, then what's the point? You know, it's like it kind of suggests he comes back later, and you, because he goes on to win, you want people to remember him from the outset and not be another Chris Underwood.
Right, exactly. So I do feel very good about Tyson and his winning chances just sheerly by virtue of how often he gets to talk about his kids. And furthermore, it does seem like he's doing a good job at this hour, slipping back into the main game. Who knows? I'm sure it can't be that long before Tyson's name starts popping up as a target. But he is certainly capable of finding idols and winning challenges and making fire. I feel like there's a lot of reason to be believing in Tyson right now. And I would honestly say Michelle and Tyson collectively have at minimum 70-75% combined equity for me at this point. Where are you on that?
That's a lot, like that, and that boxes out mathematically some people who seem to be in the mix before, and I would say even more so after this week. So that maybe let's move on to them.
Okay, like, then you tell me who was your big winner this week.
I would say Tony was a pretty big winner this week. You know, he seems to have got everyone else also speaking in terms of like lions and hyenas and vultures and scavengers and so on.
And llamas.
Yes. Yeah. Just the whole menagerie is coming out to play. But Tony is somehow at the merge, not a target, in a great position, and really speaking somewhat cogently, not just for Tony, but just in general about the way the game is going and the way his game is going in particular.
What's the word for a unicorn that has two horns, Dom? Because I'm with you. I feel like Tony could add a second unicorn horn and make another insane run through this game. I'm with you. I thought Tony was a big winner this week. And if anyone who is a parent, two separate words, is going to make it through the TV episodes without talking about that sort of thing nonstop, I would guess it would be Tony. And the editors would not feel compelled to make people root for Tony for like sentimental reasons necessarily.
Right. Yeah, you root for him because he's the court jester who also is somehow just demolishing the game at the same time.
Well, I would say the same thing about Tyson, though, too. I mean, we don't need to hear about his kids.
Sure. but we did also get this little scene from Tony where Sarah said at Tribal that this season you're not going to see the punch coming, and then it cut to Tony with this big grin on his face. And I know a lot of people read into that. That means that maybe not that Tony is going to get one over on Sarah, but that Tony might seem like he's surprisingly harmless and innocent for the time being, but if you give him room to play, he will land a knockout punch on somebody.
Oh yeah. So definitely loving that we are living in a world where Tony Vlachos is not only still in the game post-merge, has not received a single vote against him, and still very much alive in the winner mix. You'd absolutely love to see it. So the unfortunate part, though, Dom, is I have a few more people still certainly with non-zero equity here, but I feel like between the three we've talked about and then I would add Sophie to the list of main contenders at this point, but I feel like after that group, we are potentially looking at like single digit territory in terms of winner chances at this hour, as far as I would be concerned. But Sophie, I would say, still has to be up for pretty heavy consideration here. How did you feel like Sophie did this week?
I thought Sophie had a really good week. Like, she was shown as nailing the dynamics of the game, which is her whole thing, right? Yeah. Like, I think it would be more harmful if there was a big strategic development in the game that Sophie did not get to talk on than for someone like Michelle, for instance, who does not need to be at the forefront of all of those strategy conversations. But for Sophie, whose whole thing is being analytic and being smart and very savvy, if she is left out in the dark, then that could be the death knell. So love to see that part of things. And then she was shown as reassuring Adam. She turned the vote around on Wendell. She suggested his name and put that out there to cut Jeremy off at the knees, and was successful in doing that. And then the thing that people seem to hold against her this week is her like shivering and almost crying at the challenge. But we saw it in the past that crying late game humanized her to the jury somehow, first of all, but then also was seen as the one thing that could like humanize her and make her relatable to the audience too. And I don't know how successful it was in doing that, but I think that was the intent of that part of the edit in South Pacific and them leaving that in. And that could be the same thing here again too, where we see a lot of Sophie these days and she seems like very competent, very smart, but this is something that shows that, hey, she has a moment of human weakness like all of us do. Oh, and by the way, everyone else was shivering and shivering to their bones as well. So it's not like she's the only one who can't handle the weather.
Right. I would say at this point, assuming the finale begins with six people, not like the final re-enterer will make six, I feel like of the five, actually, it wouldn't even have to be people in the main game. I feel like of I have three people that I feel like will be alive on finale night, whether they have made it through the main game or re-enter on finale night. Michelle is the first one. I would say Sophie is the second one for me, where I will be very surprised if Sophie is not an active player in the finale.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that.
All right. And then I guess I will, so I don't risk forgetting to mention who the third one is, we can dive into that person now. The third person I feel is, now that they have survived this merge vote, very like, now that they're not the merge boot, I should say, they are not getting the merge boot edit. He may be voted out along the way, but if so, I feel good about his re-entry chances. I feel like Adam Klein will be there alive in the main game on finale night. Are you feeling roughly that same way, or am I mistaking just a big, interesting character for someone that I should be paying attention to long term?
My view right now is the two people most likely to be in the final three are Michelle and Adam, and that's either going to be the two of them are losing finalists, with Adam as like the no hope zero vote getter, Michelle as the The losing finalists who did much better for themselves than you'd think and came close but and gets a few votes but ultimately doesn't take it down with a Tyson or a Sophie or a Tony winning. Or it's Michelle, Adam, and maybe Ben, maybe someone else who doesn't have a real shot, and Michelle is going to be the one sweeping that up. I think those are our two sets of outcomes at this stage.
So I would say if I had to buy my Exacta ticket today, and I think I actually literally said buy me that Exacta ticket when this combination came up last week on the Edit Zone, I would buy two tickets here. I very much like whatever odds I can be offered on Michelle over either Adam and Ben or Adam and Sophie. I feel like those are two of the most likely timelines as far as I am concerned right now. And I would feel like Tyson would probably win if he made it there against any of them. If he just makes it to the finals, I feel like Tyson is in pretty good shape. But yeah, I am definitely on board with Adam in the finale, and with you that it is probably going to be as a losing finalist. And I am slightly nervous, Dom, because I have spent a lot of time talking about the prospect of Adam being a losing finalist over the course of my podcasting career. And to this point, that has not gone so well for me. But I am feeling like that is the most likely situation at this point. I'm feeling like it's either Michelle over a group of non-parents or Ben or Tyson beating that same group of non-parents plus Ben at this hour would be my strongest lead.
I could see Ben as that losing finalist too. But I really hope that we get here for a season 40 retrospective with Adam and he gets to clown on you again for counting him out and minimizing his chances the whole time.
I mean, please do it. By the way, minimizing his chances the whole time. I took the fucking kid number one overall
you
out
did.
Of 38
okay, okay.
winners.
Yeah.
Like, you will never find a bigger advocate for the talent that Adam Klein possesses, I would say, as at the very least a survivor mind. And I would say, furthermore, if he does prove to be a losing finalist this time around, yes, you can comfortably get yourself ready for me to talk about in the future how they obviously made him look worse than he was probably coming across on the island.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But I would say, Dom, I certainly agree that Tony was a big winner this week. If I'm looking at people to give these last few remaining percentages of win equity to, I actually thought one of the big winners this week for me, and at least seeming like an interesting character to keep an eye on, is the aforementioned Ben Dreeberg, and I thought he was a lot of fun once again this week in the merge.
Yeah, I don't hate that. Is Jeremy completely off the board for you, even though he seemingly had a very good week this time?
I am done chaining Jeremy after this week. I am done chaining Kim Spradlin after this week. We're just not seeing it.
It saddens me that I have to come in here and do Kim Watch every week, where it's like, did we even get a confessional from Kim this episode? Who's to say, right? Like, no one's talking about Kim. She has an idol, and she's one of the best of all time. Like, if it was going purely based on in-game positioning, and I had all the footage in front of me, Kim might be number one with the bullet, but instead we're just seeing nothing from her at all, and that's really sad.
I'm now realizing, I mean, I remember flagging this up in the pre-merge as the four people who were former guests of this podcast, Adam, Tony, Kim, and Sophie, were all getting idols and stuff pre-merge. It's pretty incredible that we're down now to the final 11. All four are still in the game. Kim may have gotten like a random vote against her, but I think Adam's the only one to get a meaningful number of votes against him. Two of them still have idols, Dom. I don't see this playing out this way. It'd be incredible if like all four of them end up making it to the finale or something. I feel like we really are the secret sauce at that point.
Yeah, say what you will for being like Steven's best friend on Survivor or whatever, but maybe there's a little podcast effect going on.
Yeah. All right. So in terms of other people, I am not done chaining at this hour. I don't feel like I need to roll through the whole list. I feel like Michelle and Tyson, easy one and two in some order at this point for me. Probably Michelle pretty noticeably ahead of Tyson still at this hour. Sophie, Tony, for sure. Ben in the mix. I think it'll be a weird story if that ends up happening, but I'm not ruling it out. The other person I feel like I can say I feel good about in terms of if they can have another big episode or two coming up, I could easily see them right back in the top tier of winner candidates if they get off to a strong kind of post-merge situation. That's Sarah Lacina. What have you been making of Sarah lately?
There's not much to make of Sarah. She just isn't that present. And as we said, with Denise's move over on a different tribe being the only big move of the game so far, we haven't needed to hear much from Sarah. And she's playing that one half of the game that she played in Game Changers of just not ruffling feathers, of just sitting back, letting the game come to her. And so you mix that with her less than telegenic personality, as she would admit. I don't think there would be much of a winner edit, even if she really slams her foot on the gas pedal going forward now.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know, Dom. I mean, back when she won Game Changers, everyone was very easily able to see that Sarah was the clear winner in her half a confessional in the first four episodes.
Well, look, you can relitigate that all you like, but I'm sitting that one out.
Okay. All right. So how about one final note here from me, Dom? I joked and was completely kidding during our podcast with, I think it was the one with Jordan, kind of locking in final predictions for like who's going to re-enter from Edge of Extinction. And I said, watch it be like Danny or someone just who's completely invisible to this point. And when we got to the beginning of the episode on Wednesday night, right away, it may have been literally the first confessional, it was very close to that, if not, was Danny giving her thoughts on everything that was about to go down. And I was sitting there going, oh, you gotta be kidding me. She's actually about to do this. I found over the course of this episode, if you look for it, man, you can talk yourself into Danny Boatwright getting the Chris Underwood treatment.
Look, someone floated that theory that Danny would be the one coming back in here this week, and I thought either this person is giving exactly the kind of absurd conspiracy theory that I revel in and enjoy hearing, or they're spoiled and they need to fuck off back to wherever they came from.
Right. I thought you were about to berate them for making up fan fiction, but I'm glad that you own that. That's the exact kind of edgelord bullshit that you would buy into yourself. Yeah.
100%. I can't even hide it.
Edge of Extinction Lord. All right. Is Boston Rob potentially in the mix for you? We saw him come really close in this re-entry challenge. If he and Amber can rack up a bunch of fire tokens and he gets three idols and every advantage in the final six re-entry, do you feel like he can convert a win here? Because for me, at least, the way that he left the game initially seemed borderline disqualifying, but other people still seem to have him in the mix.
It was, but he had a very good edge, if I do say so myself. And we saw him say he feels like if he gets back in, he can make a run at it and win the game. And that is much easier to do the second time than the first time.
Very gauche of you to say that so yourself, Dom. Everyone's judging you.
As Rick Devens and Chris Underwood would tell you themselves. Underwood tell you? I think Rob maybe does still have a shot at this, and if we think that Tyson is probably still going to be in the mix going late, then who else is there on the edge to really compete with Rob?
Well, I mean, by the time we get
I
to
guess,
that...
Like, an extra eight people is the answer, but you know what I mean. Like he has to have the highest single share of that equity, even if it's still a low share.
Given the enormous advantage that he has with the fire tokens now going forward, and this is like exactly what we were talking about preseason. I know, of course, Rob and Amber being a married couple is going to put a target on them, but there is no substitute in games like this or games like poker where people are theoretically playing an individual game, but two people have the exact same incentive. Like one of them winning, like the other one winning is just as good to me as me winning, which is the case here for Rob and Amber, is an enormous edge. There is nothing that anyone can do to compete with that sort of shared interest. But either way, I definitely agree that Rob is probably going to be in pretty good shape whenever that second re-entry rolls around. Dom, the only person I feel like we are at least slightly, or would be slightly, remiss not to bring up in the edit zone as at least drawing live. I will still take a 1 or 2% flyer on Denise Stapley. Is that reasonable to you?
It would really have to pick up soon, but this could be the beginning of something great, and I really hope it is.
I certainly hope it is. All right. So what else, if anything, Dom?
I'm out. I thought we didn't have much to talk about this week, and we're here close to 3 hours later. Not sure how much of that's going to make the final cut, but regardless, it turns out we had a lot to talk about, and it's always good to check in with you.
Did you say 3 hours later?
Possibly 2 hours later. I'm losing all sense of time and space.
You called me on Skype an hour 46 minutes ago. We did about 2 minutes before the show started.
Are you quite sure that like daylight savings time didn't kick in anywhere in there or anything like that?
I don't know how the time difference works over there in Canada, Dom. But
Look, clearly I am delirious and I need to get my rest and get my beauty sleep before I go fully insane.
I think this might be literally the shortest podcast we've done of any of this season. But I will let you get out of here, Dom. I will let the listeners get out of here as well. I am guessing we will have a more interesting kind of in-game dynamic to get to next week if it's anything other than like a really straightforward Nick Wilson boot. So I'm sure I've just jinxed it, and that is now exactly what is going to happen to make the podcast boring.
Yeah.
Right, yeah. We're kind of free-rolling. Either we get the straightforward Nick Wilson boot or we get something interesting to talk about. So can't lose there, he says now. Before whatever disaster strikes next week. But Dom, I think that will wrap us up finally. So one more time, he is on Twitter at DomHRV. I am at Colin Stone. We will talk to you guys next week. Take care, everybody.